Hello, welcome to another episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness. This is your host, George Muniz Gund. Today, I have a very special episode, a very special guest on the podcast for a very special episode. I forgot to mention, but this is the 150th episode of Unpacking Neuroqueerness, and my guest today is Jim Jarrett, my acting teacher at the school I attended, the Meisner Technique Studio in San Francisco. Jim is the last teaching protege of Sanford Meisner and the founder of director of the school. Today I'm going to ask Jim a little bit about his journey with being my teacher, watching me unmask and flourish into my true self, and we'll also talk a little bit about the training, about his experiences working with other students, perhaps who had differences, and a little bit about Jim himself. Without further ado, welcome Jim.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure and privilege to be here.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for making the time. The first thing I wanted to get into relates to my experience with going through the training and unmasking into my true self. Before the training, I used to feel like in order to be accepted, I needed to fit certain societal molds and expectations, and I needed to learn to embody behaviors and mannerisms that weren't natural to me, that were more like copying other people. And so I was highly masked. I used to be very over-analytical of myself, which led to struggles connecting with others. I'm sure you remember, like, the first interview I did with you, how different I was. And I'll never forget the impact of certain teachings in the training, such as don't be good, be fearless, and not being polite had on my unmasking journey, because after learning that, I was enough the way I am, and being encouraged to not be polite while working off another actor, and I started to feel a lot more freedom to a level that I hadn't experienced before. And I also remember you saying, Jim, that this training, you said to the whole class in first session, that this training would change your life and it would impact your relationships with every person, and I definitely felt that happen. So that leads me to my question. Jim, tell us a little bit about the impact you've seen the training have on me, and if any of it reminds you of the impact those teachings had on you when you were going through it with Sanford Meisner, and maybe other students as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, George, you already summarized it. You know, you came to me as someone, as you said, masked, highly intellectual, felt the need to just fit in and really, in many ways, you know, not honor your, no criticism, but just to try to conform and not get bullied and treated, can I swear?
Yeah,
by the way,
swear.
Not being treated shitty by people, you felt that, you know, this need to conform, so not an authentic version of you, right? But as you're talking, I'm going, oh my gosh, George, not only was that true of you, but honestly, that's true of virtually every single student that comes to me. And we'll get to that, because right now your question's specifically about you, but it's an inevitable byproduct of this training. That's why I do say on the first day of class or early on, this training will impact your life in such a profound way. It literally will change it for the better, because the technique, the genius of what Sanford Meisner created, was to help everyone step into this more authentic version of themselves, to get out of their heads and work from their guts, and to really embrace that they are enough, so to quit giving that power away. So you are someone that flourished beautifully. I remember you vividly. I remember your interview, because we had mutual friends and relationships, and they asked if I would be willing to meet with you and in consideration for you to study with me. And I said, of course, absolutely. And I remember when I met you, And I could tell that you were someone that was very introverted and on himself, very nervous. And again, this is most everybody that comes to me for that first interview. And I remember thinking to myself, and this happens often, where I know this training will help this person. I'm positive of that for all the reasons we've now talked about. But I wasn't quite sure whether you were going to be able to go on the full journey and whether you even wanted to. I wasn't closing the door to it. I just remember that was my first impression. And then as the training went on, again, you were just a beautiful student and a beautiful example of what's possible if you can hang in there, because you had bumpy days, man.
Yeah.
You had tough days in there, like all of us did. But you were resilient, you were humble, you were courageous. I'm not flattering you. This is the truth. You had no quit in you. So I remember very early on going, oh my goodness, this kid's going to be just fine. He has all the qualities needed to grow into this. And I also want to add that your classmates were also incredibly supportive as well, in terms of just, you know, and of each other, not just specifically you, of just helping each other, just, you know, because everybody's different. You know, the beautiful thing about teaching actors, George, you may recall me saying often, was that you're the piano, you're the instrument.
Yeah.
And my great teacher, Sanford Meisner, would say to be a world-class actor, you have to have a world-class instrument to play, and you are that instrument. So again, the healthier we are, the freer we are, the more that we really do embody and make peace with all that we are and are not, allows us to show up and not care what people think. That's really at the core of the Meisner technique. It's just freedom. It really is. And it's not by accident. It's by design. So I knew if you could hang in there, great things would happen for you. And they did. They did. You blossomed beautifully. I think that I remember so many of your family members on that final day of class came up to me. And, you know, look, they're trying to celebrate me or whatever. And I'm like, hey, man, it's George. It's the genius of my teacher, and it's George. I have my part, and that part is that I'm a purist. I'm a conduit to my teacher's brilliance. I take seriously the privileged role of being asked by him to carry on his teaching legacy. Okay, so there's, you know, I have my part in it. But, George, it was you. And you just blossomed, and they all, to a person, said, we barely recognize him in terms of he's just a completely different person, in terms of his confidence and his belief in himself.
Yeah, I certainly recall that transformation as well, and I think, you know, how it happened gradually, and I remember the struggles that you mentioned. It was hard, like, first session. I remember the first, I won't say what it was, but the first exercise that we did, that we worked on, I struggled a lot with having urgency with it. And I remember...
Oh, let's try to remember that.
Yeah. I even, like, there was a period where I wouldn't understand that I didn't have enough urgency, and I would, like a lot of other students tend to in the beginning of the training, I would feel defensive because I just didn't understand, like, how deep it really goes. And then I felt I felt like with time I was able to understand that better and grow, and yeah, it was just really powerful, like, in terms of unmasking. I always think about that, of how powerful it was to really let go. And I think part of why I struggled a little bit in the beginning was because in the very beginning, I still wasn't fully unmasked.
Sure,
I think,
of course.
Yeah, I think it took maybe, I don't know if you would agree, but I want to say maybe until, like, the end of third session or, like, second year.
I agree completely, George. It was a slow progression initially. A lot of one step forward, two steps back. Again, for almost every single student, for what it's worth. But boy, man, I absolutely remember when you turned a corner. I can picture you one day in class where all you did the best. I remember saying to you, I go, that's the best technique you've ever done. And to do the technique well, for all your listeners, you have to now be incredibly present. You have to be out of your head. And with that, all nerves go away. It's impossible to be nervous if your focus is off yourself. And you used to suffer from a lot of tension and nerves prior to the exercise beginning. Once the exercise began, moments missed. And so you're this evolution. But man, all of a sudden, it's like you are riding this horse and you caught stride. And honestly, you really never looked back. From that point forward, you really began to do the kind of work that would be considered solid work by anybody. You know, you did. You turned a beautiful corner.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly felt that happen also. And I think I remember that class that you mentioned where I had like that big breakthrough. Mm-hmm. Doing the technique and just like really unleashing and being fully unmasked. And yep. I remember how satisfying that was, because I feel like not just in the training, but in life till that point, I don't think I was ever as unmasked as I was in that exercise, because I felt, and I remember you mentioning also how it is a very, like, I mean, it depends by culture and everything, but like in society, a lot of people, not just neurodivergent people, get conditioned to be polite or to not be a certain way. So I felt that impact for sure. And I remember also how my family noticed how, the next thing I wanted to talk about is more related to developing strategies. One thing I noticed about myself and about others is that others that feel different or just maybe work in different ways than most people, that we tend to create our own strategies when it comes to getting things done. And I remember there's one exercise that you teach it's the first thing you teach in the business class.
Yes.
Are
you talking about top downs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. That's okay. I don't mind. All right. Yeah. It'll help.
So top downs, because it's and it relates a lot to breaking things down into subtasks.
Correct. Yeah. It's the old, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Mm-hmm. The top-down concept I started to advancing for myself about 40 years ago, 40, because I was a procrastinator. I had great intentions. The old phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We want to get stuff done, but talk is cheap. And we tend to, over the course of our upbringing, we tend to start losing what I call personal integrity. Let's say we're going to go to the store that day, or we're going to register our car, or we're going to call this person, and we don't do it.
Yeah.
And it's very subtle, but it's also very insidious, and it's like a slow leak into our bank of personal integrity. So most everybody really struggles with procrastination, and that's just easy stuff, basic stuff. But then we shame ourselves, we feel guilt, we drink the poison, and now we're it's even harder. It's like we're digging a hole. And then the reason why I started to really go after this is, man, if your word isn't gold and you have big dreams, and George, as you know, in this industry, you know, to be an actor, I've been doing this for 37 years, to make a living at this is almost impossible.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And to do it year after year, pretty much is. And that I've been part of that group, a great part of that is due to my addressing the procrastinator inside of me. And so this top-down concept was something that, exactly, George, people get overwhelmed by the enormity of trying to get their film to Sundance, let's say. They're like, oh my God, they can't even open the computer and start typing. And so by taking it down to these actionable steps, picture a ladder with not big steps, but like teeniest steps, just a ladder that really would only need 30 steps, a fireman's ladder to three floors. These ladders have like 150 steps. It's just and it just breaks it down and makes things that seem overwhelming no longer overwhelming.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that was one of the exercises that was really helpful for me, because I think before that I hadn't really thought that way of like breaking things into subtasks and how it really helps get things done instead of just saying, oh, I want to get this done. And yeah, I've talked to other students
who felt the same way. Good.
Yeah. A little bit now on the link in between masking, acting, and the Meisner technique a little more. One of the main aspects of masking for me was studying all kinds of people and trying to replicate all their unique mannerisms and behaviors. And I think that's one positive.
Sure.
One positive was that it eventually drew me to acting because it drew me to want to try on all these different characters. And I felt like I was already doing that in a way. But of course, like, I learned how to do it a lot more authentically, like from the gut, which was very different because I used to be very much so in my head. And so a lot of other actors have expressed similar feelings. I was wondering if you felt that you had to mask like certain things, or if you like in terms of socially and everything.
Yeah. Well, that's not what drew me to acting, but I do understand your point, and after teaching literally thousands of people over the years, that's certainly the case for a lot of people, and understandable. And you are right. There's some real positives to that, right? As you were talking, I was thinking, I have a friend of mine that shot a film in the South, and he really struggled with his accent. He goes, I had one down, but it just felt cliche. It just didn't feel like I'd earn it. And he walked into a hardware store. He needed to buy something. He was like, I don't know, somewhere in the South, Georgia, deep in the South. He walked into a hardware store, and there was this good old boy behind the counter. And as soon as he spoke, he goes, oh, my God, holy hell, that's the accent. That's the cadence. So you talk about, you know, mirroring and masking. And this is what we as actors definitely do. We are ambassadors on behalf of the human experience. Our job is to study and file away whether it's mannerisms, behavior, character elements, characteristics of people. Absolutely true. But as you know, George, as well, the other component of the Meisner technique is all about authenticity, right? About that you are enough and stepping into that too. So it's a bit of a contradiction. On the one hand, we're trying to pay attention to what we're not and what's out there. And when I say steal from it, I just simply mean for our art and yet be real about it. For me, what brought me to acting was just really straightforward. I saw a film that it was called The Deer Hunter, and I that film punched me in the soul. It was in the 80s. I was trying to figure out what I did want to do with my life, what my purpose was, not just a job, but what I'd been put on this earth to do. Acting and filmmaking was not even on the radar. I never acted in my life. I was a jock. And when I experienced this movie, and I say experienced it because that's what happened, and when it was over, I couldn't move, George. I sat there in the movie theater, and I literally was emotional. I was angry. This film was about the Vietnam War and not just the fallout for the people that actually go over and fight, but for the people that they come back to and how destroyed everyone gets by it, the fallout after the fact. And it just broke my heart. And it really bothered me. And I had never been bothered by a film before like this. I had never been, and I'll even use the word haunted because it's accurate. And so that film was the catalyst for me to begin this journey. And again, that was in 19, that actually started in 84. I began officially my career in 87. Spent a few years just getting my stuff together, George, trying to deal with all my procrastination and bad habits and things and save money and get out of debt and really clean up my act. So I spent several years just setting the table before I even felt ready to go after something so difficult. A lot like somebody in a, you know, back in the Christopher Columbus days, you know, you don't just hop in the boat going, hey, I'm going to go for a sail out to the middle of nowhere here. I need a good boat, and I need to have, you know, supplies, etc. So that was my approach. But again, sorry, I'm getting a little wordy with this. To your question, to answer it, I became an actor not to unmask, but to truly just say stuff that I wanted to say, to tell stories that mattered to me in hopes that if I told it well, it could kind of have, it could have the kind of impact like the Deer Hunter had on me, that I could, and thank God I found my teacher, because Sanford Meisner believed that to be an actor was important, that it was a noble profession, that if you told stories as actors in an elite way, and by, for Sandy, that meant truthful, believable, that your work's believable, that you can turn a cold piece of paper into a believable human being, literally, that you could change people's lives forever through your storytelling, through your work. I'd experienced that, and I wanted that. So that's what my motivation was.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely relate also to wanting to tell stories. And I think especially after I went through the training and I was unmasking, and you probably remember, it was in the business class that I really shifted that, when we started like talking about how to market ourselves and everything, and like the stories we want to tell, like our identity as actors and all that, and that's when I became an advocate.
It was unbelievable. You it's like a light bulb went on for you, and you've never looked back, and everyone who knows you and cares about you is so damn proud of you. And I saw the day it happened where you're like, holy hell, this is why I think I was doing all this.
Yeah it was really powerful. It right after the business class, I remember talking about it the last day of the business class, that I was going to start an Instagram page. And so I went on and did that, and I started, in the beginning it was mostly sharing things that I was reading from other advocates and I really resonated with, and then eventually I started writing my own stuff, and it was a whole process because I started writing only on Instagram in the beginning, and then I realized that I just had so much to say, and you can only fit like so much in there, and like not everyone has social media, so I wanted to have a larger reach.
True.
And then I started thinking about making a blog, and I was just a little bit worried because I wasn't sure how I would promote my blog. And then I remember I was talking to my dad one day, like I was like, yeah, I've been thinking about starting this blog, but I don't know, like, if people are gonna see it, because one thing I liked about social media was that it's like easy to promote stuff on there, but then my dad made me realize, like, he was like, well, you could do the blog, but you could, and then you could share your posts on the link to your post on social media. And then I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I could do that. And then I decided to do that, and I started the blog. And then I want to say a couple months after that, I started getting into podcasts, and I started it was a similar kind of thing. I was listening to like podcasts by other advocates and really liked them, and I was like, and then I started realizing, you know, I could do something like this. And then I started it. I remember just recording like the first episode, and it still says, like, in the first episode I say, welcome to the first episode of Unpacking Neurodiversity. And I ended up changing the name to Neuroqueerness. But I just left the first episode like that because I felt like it's a reminder of like, oh, this was actually going to be called something else. And then I remember I sat on that episode for 12 days before I published it, because I did get a little bit stuck. Like, I felt myself getting stuck back in the, like, you know, being afraid to be good, or not so much even just that, but like, I guess starting to over worry again about the perception and how it was going to be received and whatnot. But then I reminded myself, like you used to say, there's a guy that's in the back of the bus that comes to the front of the bus, and he's like, you had a name for it, the like basically like the negative voice in your head.
Sure, you know, we teach off this all the time, right? Mm-hmm. That we have, excuse me, every one of us has inside of us this critic. It's just a matter of how loud he is and who do you want driving your bus, right? Do you want the healthiest version of you or do you want that guy? And even if that guy's not driving your bus, he's on the bus.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you just want to be, you don't want to be ruled by and live your life small because you're you know, either afraid of making mistakes or of the judgment of others or falling short. You know, to just, again, to be live a life of truly not caring what people think. And again, I don't mean in some narcissistic, bratty way. I'm not saying treat people crappy or anything like that. When I say to not care what people think, I always say, you know, that's what charisma is, George. Somebody that has tremendous charisma, you know what it is? It's freedom. They feel without arrogance that they're enough, that they value themselves. They like themselves. They have something to say, and somebody with charisma feels the same way about you. By the way, you'll feel welcomed. You'll feel warmed by them. Whereas ego is something else entirely. So, yeah, the bus driver. Who do you want driving your bus? Do you want this voice, this critic, this hypercritic, this cynic, this person that wants to keep driving you into the ditch and have you, you know, fall short of what you deserve in your life? Or do you want, you know, the healthiest version of you? And of course, you know, I would hope just about everybody would be able to easily say that version, but that's just because it's easy to say doesn't mean it's easy to do. And that also is not just the work of this training. Of course, that's the work in all of our lives.
Yeah. Definitely. I feel like that's definitely one teaching from the training that translates to life in general. And that's what led me to finally publish that episode. 12 days later, I looked at it on my computer and it was still there. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to try to be good. I'm just going to do it. And I published it and I even went with a different name. And then I remember it just evolved because I had so many things to say, and I would do an episode about like one subtopic. At one point, I was pumping out episodes like almost daily because it was just like these short little episodes of just me on my own. And then I started having guests, and I remember my first guest was my sister, Luana, who was at graduation.
Sure.
And it was, I remember, like, that was a really powerful episode because we just, like, talked about things that we had never talked about before.
Beautiful.
And then, you know, I was able to have more family members and friends on and even a few Meisner Technique students. And it's hard to believe that now I have this is the 150th episode. Gosh, like, also remaining humble, like, because I don't like to brag either, but it's like the fact that I have almost 14,000 downloads now, like, I didn't certainly did not predict that or expect that. So yeah, definitely I feel like a lot of it is due to the training and what we learned in the business class as well. So I have a few more questions. And the next question the next two questions are more related about reflecting on yourself through others, like students that you've taught. And so, has working with all kinds of different students over so many years made you see some of their differences, strengths, and struggles in yourself? And if so, what are some examples of that?
Yeah, of course, right? You know, you see yourself in certain students. They remind you of how you were when you went through the training, both positive qualities and the qualities that got in the way of learning and being open. So there's no doubt. And one of the, you know, privileges of teaching acting and actors, and especially this way of working, is, and I mentioned it earlier, is that you are the piano. You know, how many times did we say, George, don't compare your instrument to anybody else in this room? Right. Mm-hmm. Because you all have your own unique experiences. And that means that there's never been a piano like yours ever. And you act from who and what you are. It doesn't mean you need to have a horrible life to be an actor. It just means you draw on so much of your life experiences. You do. And then once you really understand what acting's about in terms of being able to develop your imagination, and now you can take from the realities of your life and use your imagination to expand and grow that, to experience all kinds of things that you've actually never literally experienced. But to do that, you're going to come up against your stuff. And to answer your question, you know, I not only see me and my students and certainly that makes me a better teacher, more compassionate, but honestly, George, just to the point of the teaching is each one of you is different. And so my job is to try to look at each student separate from anyone else and try my best to help them as they start to untangle and get free of all their wounds and blocks. Again, this ain't therapy, but this is Sanford Meisner talking, he'd say, this ain't therapy, but it's incredibly therapeutic. It has to be. Again, it goes back to the beautiful art form called being an actor. We are the instrument. So the healthier you are, the freer you are, the more self-aware you are, the better actor you'll be. It doesn't mean, you know, here's another beautiful teaching of Sanford Meisner's, the seed to every character you will ever play is already inside you. Like all of my students, every student inside of them has this guy on their bus, their bench, guy or gal, but this dynamic, this component, this character element, where they're incredibly noble and honest and sneaky and deceitful and a really, really good person and a really, really selfish person and everything in between. Yeah. And I can go on and on listing all the positive and negatives of being in this human experience. We all have it. And one of the beautiful things about being an actor is to stop denying it. It doesn't mean you want to live it out. I don't want to be a shitbag to people. I don't want to be selfish. I don't want to be that guy, but I can be that guy. He's in there. So it is when you work with students, you see that stuff come out. Earlier you mentioned that you were, you know, early on a bit defensive. You know, you get, and by the way, you weren't bad at all, George. You weren't. But, you know, I get that. I get people mm-hmm. who are defensive, who make it difficult to teach. And at some point, if they just can't address where that comes from, because usually what it means is when they were young and they got critiqued by teachers, parents, whatever, there's a lot of shame around it. Mm-hmm. So when you go to teach them, especially because you're teaching quote unquote them, meaning they're the instrument, they can take it personally and they can get prickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a real dynamic. And so at some point you get some students where you just literally say, I can't work with you. I'm the wrong teacher for you. You know, you're just not like, we can't do this. So it's not working. But for most, yeah, I'm able to see what's going on and do my best to help them heal. And again, without enabling, without getting, you know, again, it's a fine line, George, because you don't want to overstep. And there are certain things that for some people go way deeper than what this training is about. And I have to be very sensitive to that. But I also have to be, if I'm working with actors, you have to be incredibly self-aware of the human condition.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I remember seeing that, like, noticing that in class also, like, all how everyone, like, has their own stuff, for
yep.
sure. Like,
yep.
And I noticed, like, I do remember, like, having some classmates that did really struggle to take certain teachings mm-hmm. and I think as always with any group there were like a couple conflicts and
yep.
I remember I even had a partner that was not very
mm-hmm.
committed to the scene and I remember because I remembered how you talked about how it takes two to dance or
yep.
like how you know, if you're not giving your best self or like really working hard on it can affect the other person too.
Yeah.
And so I definitely noticed that with one certain partner that I worked with, but
and then we got rid of him.
Yeah. Well, he ended up quitting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, which is great. You know, again, I mean, look, you teach 100 students, you have 100 students, you, believe me, there's going to be a couple where it's just not a good fit, and that's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
I don't take it personally whatsoever.
Yeah. I think you might have already touched a little bit on this, but the last question I wanted to ask is, because I feel like a lot of people who feel different like me, they end up being drawn to the world of creative arts and performance and become dreamers. I noticed that most of them, like you say also, never following their dreams because of shyness or fear of not being good enough. And I feel like it's still, I mean, of course, like I've unlearned that by now, but it's, I definitely notice, like, when I talk, like, it's probably the number one thing I hear from people when I talk to them is, like, they're like, oh, yeah, I really wanted to do acting, too, but I wasn't good enough, or I have stage fright, or I'm too shy, I could never do it. What is the main piece of advice that you have for those folks?
Self-love, you know? Just keep working on yourself. I'm enough. I've got something to say. And people, if you know, George, as you know, I do all these shows. I do a lot of live theater and I tour. And a big house for me is, you know, 1,000, 1,200 people. Usually 800 to 1,000 is a usual house. And my show's wildly successful, my shows. But there's going to be some people that just aren't going to like it. And there's nothing I can do about it. And I, when I say I don't care, I care very much that I've shown up, that I've done my job. I'm a pro. I care very much about doing everything I can to deliver the goods. But I can't care. Well, I can, but I don't choose to care what people think in terms of them, let's say, not liking me or my art. Now, again, if I respect this person and I've done something offensive or shitty, then of course I'm not talking about that, George. Again, I'm just talking about as an artist, you know, your question is, you know, what advice would you give people who feel a bit locked up, who aren't going after the things because of shyness, because of these things? And just for what it's worth, George, that's most everybody. Most everybody is not living their dreams. Most everybody is settling. Most everybody is living a much smaller version of who they really know they are. But they're wounded. They've got this imprinting and programming and conditioning that they're not enough, that they're not good enough. That most people who are shy, really early on, life wasn't safe. They're like a little turtle, so they're going to barely peek their head out so they don't get smacked or teased or laughed at or ridiculed. So they've bonded to the wounds of their past, right? They've been defined by these moments and events, and in so doing, they are now going to crawl inside a box, a very small box, put the lid on, and stay small. And I say that with compassion. You know, that's, again, George, it's most everybody in life has very limiting beliefs about themselves. So for me, the key to live an authentic life, to live a life of no regret, to go after your dreams, man, you've got to believe in yourself. You've got to believe that you've got something to say, and again, without ego, but truly just the sincere desire to express and help, like what you're doing with this podcast. I'm sure some people subscribe and then quit. And, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And some people will listen to every episode. And you know where I'm going.
Yeah.
And all you can do, George, is continue to do your best to try to be a voice and provide a voice of others for others. And if it resonates for you this week, wonderful. If it doesn't, well, you know, I'll just keep marching forward. And there it is. It's doing it because you want to express and you feel like you really do have something to say, and you found your calling, and you're not doing it to collect the good opinion of others. So many actors doing this are very insecure. They want attention. There's a stereotype that actors are starved for attention because, ready? Most actors are starved for attention. They were in a play in high school. Everyone clapped one night and took pictures and brought them flowers. It was the greatest night of their life, and they've been chasing that drug ever since. Yeah. And okay, but now back to my teacher. Sandy would say, get your ego out of your art. You know, most people are in this industry have a lot of ego, and they're doing it because they want praise, they want attention, they want things. Again, I'll quote my teacher one last time. He said, most people doing this just want some good reviews to send back to everyone back home in South Dakota to say, see, I told you I was special. How true that is. And so, for me anyway, my opinion, that's not sustainable, and it's certainly a crappy way to go through your dream in your life, to try to prove everybody wrong. Yeah. And to try to be validated. You know, that's, you're trying to fill a void and a wound. That's, a lot of art comes from pain, I get that. But I would rather heal my stuff and continue to tell other stories that are healthier, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I have noticed how a lot of people are just drawn to the response, like, of others and how it's going to be received by others, but not enough on how they feel about it. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's definitely another really important teaching. Well, those are all the questions I have for you today, but I wanted to thank you again for coming on, because you were a really big part of my journey of unmasking and becoming an advocate and starting this podcast. So I think it's very fitting that you are the guest for the 150th episode. And thanks again.
You're welcome, George. I'm incredibly proud of you. I watched you literally blossom through the training. And certainly a good portion of that was the genius of what Sanford Meisner created. There's no doubt. But George, you know, it was you. You did the work, and you hung in there. And it's just been an absolute pleasure to watch you grow into your voice and your life's purpose. And I know that there'll be other things besides this, but hell, if this was the only thing you chose to do with it, what a beautiful thing you're doing, because I'm positive you're helping others find their voice too. So again, thank you for having me on, and whatever I can do for you, I'll always do.
Thank you, Jim.
You got it, pal.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you all next time.